But coming here, I find only a set of stepping stones. Joshua said, you see only the stepping stones and do not see the stone bridge. The monk said, what stone bridge? Joshua said, it lets donkeys cross over and horses cross over. Secho's verse, no show of transcendence, his path was high. If you've entered the great sea of Zen, you could catch a giant turtle. I can't help laughing at old Kankei, his contemporary, who said, it is as quick as an arrow, a mere waste of labor. Thank you so much for coming here to practice Zen this morning on this late summer Saturday. Thank you so much for coming. I'm sure you've noticed this collective energy. You know, it's so important to practice on your own. But when people sit together like this in an extended period of time, you know, the collective energy is really palpable. You know, you can really feel it just coming into the room. When you sit down with other people who are in deep samadhi, it draws you into deep samadhi. You know, there's a part of your mind that is aware of it even before your conscious mind is aware of it. And that, I think, is one of the reasons people come back again and again to this room. So, you know, sometimes Saturday comes and you set the alarm clock and then you think, oh, I'm really tired. But sometimes, you know, you listen to that voice that says, get up and go to practice. And you listen to that voice, you come here and you bathe yourself in this wonderful, wonderful Dharma energy. So thank you so much for coming. So today's Teisho is entitled Jiaozhou's Stone Bridge. And this is from a period, let me just say, some of you are new to Zen. And I'm so glad you're here. Joshu is the Japanese, Jiaozhou is the Mandarin name for a very famous Chan, very famous Zen teacher in the Tang Dynasty. And he was an unusual person because, you know, it was often the case that people in China at this time decided to follow the way, Fo Jiao, when they were in their 20s. So, you know, maybe mid-20s, somebody might decide to start practicing Chan or becoming a monk or a nun. But Jiaozhou, Joshu, was very young. He was like 17 years old. And he went to a sesshin, a Chan Chi, and he had a great awakening experience. Now, we actually have people in our group who have practiced at 17. Some of you know Masae Hori. And she was practicing in our group when she was only 17. And she was at the last sesshin and is a very deep sitter. But it's rather unusual for people that young to have the depth, the psychological depth, to follow this path. So Jiaozhou was really unusual in just choosing to go to a sesshin. But he went to one and he had a deep experience of his Buddha nature, his fundamental nature. After having that experience, what we call in Zen, his doubt sensation was aroused. Now, in Zen, we say there are three pillars of Chan, three pillars of Zen. The first pillar is great trust. Great trust. You know, because, you know, if you decide to practice Zen seriously, you know, that means sitting often, maybe every day. You know, at first you might sit for 20 minutes, but eventually you might be sitting for an hour a day. You come here on a Saturday and you might spend 5 hours. If you come to a sesshin, which is so crucial to Zen, you'll be spending eight to 10 hours a day on the cushion. So, you know, this is unusual because, you know, if you practice Zen, you don't get a grade. See, so, you know, in high school, you know, at the end of every semester, you get a set of grades. You know, algebra, hopefully A, B, you know, English, something, social studies, something. You know, if you have a job, every 2 weeks you get a paycheck, right? So, you know, there's a reward if you do this. And if you study hard in school, you know, you get a better grade. If you work in your job, you might get some overtime pay or promotion. You know, but with Chan, with Zen, there's no overtime pay. There's no promotion. There's no report card. So people who follow this path are unusual people. You know, it's unusual people follow this path. Most people would say, what are you doing? What are the benefits? You know, where's the report card? Where's the paycheck? See? But somebody who decides to follow the great way is moved by some powerful impulse in herself or in himself. And even without fully knowing what it is or what it entails, the person says yes to that power, to that voice inside herself, inside himself. And if you ask somebody, what are you doing? You know, they're likely, if they stop and think about it, say, I don't know. They might say, I want to achieve enlightenment. You say, what is enlightenment? I don't know. See, so first pillar of Zen is great trust. When you sit down on the cushion, you're actually exercising, manifesting great trust. You don't know where this path is taking you. You know, when you sit down on the cushion, you don't even know what's going to happen in the next half hour. You know, sometimes you sit down on the cushion and your legs hurt a lot from the beginning. Sometimes it's like a magical sit. You go into deep samadhi, deep ding, and you just stay in deep ding the whole time. And then you come out and it's like, wow, that was wonderful. And the next time you get to the cushion, you think, oh, I can't wait. And then it's a struggle the whole time. You're covered with sweat. So you're always uncertain, uncertain outcome. No paycheck, no report card. But some people are attuned to the depth, to their own depths, the depths of their own mind. And they hear or feel something deep inside them saying, you must do this. You have to do this. I have to know, see, who are we? Where do we come from? And where are we going? See? And so the people who set out on the road of Chan, the road of Zen, have great trust. See, now, the second pillar of Zen is great determination. See, so to walk this path, you need to have determination. You need to have commitment. You know, if you go to sesshin, you're sitting 8 hours a day. You know, that takes determination. You know, one of the interesting things, though, about determination is that it's not something we bring automatically. It's something we discover in practice. So, you know, when I first started practicing Zen with Genki Roshi in Seattle with my Shifu, I would sit once a week. You know, but after a while, if I didn't meditate, when I didn't meditate, it felt different. I felt less focused, calm, less balanced. So I started sitting often, more than once a week, like almost every day. And eventually I began to go to our center in the morning to sit. And that was difficult for me because I was a late riser when I was in college. I would get up, you know, at like 9 o'clock sometimes. I picked my courses so I didn't have to have morning courses. And getting up at 4:30 to get to the Zen Center by 7 o'clock was a big challenge for me, you know. Get to the Zen Center by 5:30 was a big challenge for me. You know, so I'd have to get up at 4:30, quickly wash my face, catch a ride with my friends, and we would go to the Zen Center and start sitting at 5:30, and then at 7 o'clock, we would have breakfast. For me, this was murder at first, you know. And during the day, I felt like I was hallucinating. I was so disoriented. But, you know, little by little, I began to enjoy getting up. And when I would go to sit at the Zen Center in the morning, I would come out of the Zen Center with unusual energy. See, this unusual, where is this energy coming from? So, great trust, but also great determination. And the more you practice, the deeper, the stronger your determination becomes. It's like developing a muscle that allows you to, do things you never thought you could do. You know, my first sesshin, you know, I could barely get through half a day, and the whole time I thought of running away. I couldn't run away because we were on an island, and there was no ferry to pick me up. But I wanted to. But around day three, I realized I don't want to run away, and I began to develop this power or this inner force that allowed me to continue. See, so great trust, great determination, and the last one is great doubt. Great doubt. Now, you know, so great trust, great determination, and great doubt. Great doubt doesn't mean, what am I doing here? It's too early in the morning, I need a cup of coffee. It means that you really have to know who you are, where you come from, and where you're going. And right now, you know, most people don't know any of those things. Most people can't answer those questions because they're only half a person. They're only half a person. Especially in the modern world, people are strangers to themselves. Strangers to themselves. You know, we don't know who we are because we live in a very small world. We live in the world of the conscious mind. And almost exclusively, we live in that world. So, when you're about 6 years old or seven years old, around then, you go to school. And in school, you study, you learn how to write letters, right? You learn how to print your letters. You learn basic mathematics, 4 + 4 = 8. You know, you learn, teacher reads you stories, and that process goes on for 12 years. And then if you go to college, if you're in the 20% of Americans who go to college, you know, that process intensifies. So, you know, I can remember, even in high school, you know, I would spend all evening, night after night, on my homework. I had calculus, I was studying French, I had to read novels and write about novels for my English class. You know, so all the time I was using my conscious mind and developing this wonderful tool, which is the mind, the conscious mind, right? I love reading. I actually enjoyed studying calculus and trigonometry. You know, those all made my life richer and better. When I went to college, you know, I was a double major. I read in English and anthropology. You know, I was reading all the time, and I had to write papers. This was back in the days before computers. Before there were computers, there used to be something called a typewriter. It was a primitive machine that would type papers using a ribbon that had ink on it. And so instead of having like a printer attached to your computer, there was a little machine you type, you hit the keys, and these little hammers with letters at the end of them would hammer the hammer through the inked ribbon onto the paper. And I would type. I had so many papers to write for my college courses that the little hammers would break on my Smith Corona typewriter, and I'd have to take them in and get them soldered back on. And everybody could hear me clacking away on my typewriter. So, you know, I got a really good education for my conscious mind. But I didn't develop the other part of myself. You know, it's like there's a part of ourselves which is really invisible. It's really not visible. It's the unconscious mind. There's an unconscious mind. And in our society, we don't know how to get access to the unconscious mind or have a healthy relationship to our unconscious mind. For the most part, our unconscious minds are strangers to us, even though it's half of who we really are. What happens to people is that they often have a personal crisis. And maybe over time they develop more and more anxiety, or they develop more and more anger, or they begin to have a drinking problem or substance abuse problem. Sometimes people have an emotional crisis. And in our culture, those people make a good decision. Hopefully they make this decision. They go to see, say, a psychotherapist. And the function of a psychotherapist is to introduce you to a stranger. You know, you have this other part of yourself that you haven't accessed, right? And so, you know, one function of psychotherapy is to introduce you to the part of yourself you have not ever learned about in school. People who have drinking problems might go to a psychotherapist because they want to stop drinking. Or people who have anger issues might go to a psychotherapist because they want to stop being angry. See, but that's still the conscious mind speaking. There's another mind, a deeper mind, which we need to learn how to get into contact with. So if you go to a psychotherapist and say, I have a drinking problem, I need to stop drinking, you know, the therapist might not talk to you about drinking for a long time. You know, the therapist might talk to you about many other things and want you to talk about things that might seem to have nothing to do with drinking. You know, if you know anything about psychotherapy, you go in and you talk to the therapist, and the therapist asks you questions, and the therapist might say, tell me something about your childhood. The therapist, you know, might ask you something about your friends in school. And, you know, little by little, things you've forgotten about or things you thought of were unimportant begin to bubble up to the surface. And in particular, feelings begin to bubble up to the surface, you know. Often in a psychotherapeutic situation, you know, when people are speaking, they remember things they've forgotten, or they discover feelings they didn't know they had. You know, so it might be that a person in childhood was, physically abused. And then, you know, in the course of psychotherapy, you know, the person realizes that remembers those experiences of abuse, and then remembers being constantly afraid. You know, and at some point the person might realize that he is still constantly afraid, even though his father or mother may be 1,000 miles away. So, you know, consciously, if you ask the person, are you afraid? The person will say, of course not. Me? Afraid? Afraid of what? But see, under the surface, in the unconscious mind, the person is still maybe a 7-year-old child hiding in the bedroom closet, see? So there's like the conscious mind and its life, and there's the unconscious mind and its life. And in our culture, we don't have very many tools for accessing our unconscious mind. And so we live as like strangers to ourselves. You know, it's like the greatest, largest part of ourselves is really unfamiliar to us. And something like psychotherapy is a really wonderful way to begin to discover something about that other part of ourselves. You know, and people have breakthroughs in psychotherapy where they discover that, you know, they're drinking because they're always afraid. They're carrying around fear. And when they drink, they feel less afraid, see? So, you know, your conscious mind sent you to the therapist to eliminate your drinking problem. But the drinking problem was just a symptom of a deeper problem, right? And that's a complicated matter. It's like constantly being afraid, constantly feeling unloved, feeling lonely and undefended. All of those feelings factor into the behavior of, say, drinking compulsively. So, you know, psychotherapy is a really great practice. And in Chan, in Zen, there are also some elements of psychotherapy. So some koans really are asking you to deal with, to open up the door into your unconscious and see what's there. And of course, when the small mind, the thinking mind, looks into the unconscious, all it ever sees is blankness or emptiness. But when we work on a koan, we begin to get access to this part of ourselves. And the way we do this is not by talking with a psychotherapist, but by sitting on a cushion and focusing on the breath until we can go into a stabilized consciousness, stabilized, calm, balanced consciousness. This is often called samadhi or ding. So, you know, until you can get into samadhi, ding, deeply, not much can happen. You know, so the first part of Zen practice is learning how to stabilize the body and the mind in samadhi. And when you enter samadhi, you'll notice that you have fewer thoughts. Your thoughts are still there, but they're not at the center of your attention. If you're watching your breath is at the center of your attention. And the thoughts are coming and going, but you're not holding on to them. And so you're following the breath out, and you follow the next breath out, and you follow the next breath out. And you begin to notice that things feel a little different. You know, you might feel like your head is stuffed with cotton, or like your hands or your face are disappearing. You might feel very heavy, like a rock on the ground. There's many different ways people experience themselves or experience their bodies in samadhi. If you've never had any of these experiences, please don't worry about it, right? So sometimes after these talks, people come up to me and they're worried. They say, but I've never had that. It's like, but well, you're obviously in deep samadhi. You sit for an hour and a half and you don't move. So please don't worry if you're not having those particular samadhi experiences. But you can always, a teacher can always tell who's in samadhi because the body is very still. Very, very still. And when the body is still, it means the mind is often very still too. So when people are fidgeting or moving around, you know they're probably not, you know they're definitely not in deep samadhi. So when the body becomes still, the mind is still. And when you focus on the breath with a still, balanced mind, the breath carries you out into wuxin, into emptiness. And in the Zen tradition, we put a great deal of emphasis on entering deep wuxin, deep muxin, empty mind, the mind of emptiness. And when you follow the breath out and you start to enter emptiness mind, muxin, you know, the teacher will often give you the koan mu, or calling mu. And instead of following the breath out and counting with a number, you follow the breath out and you'll call mu, mu, like that. And as you focus on mu, if you focus on mu or you focus on wu, there's no room for anything else except that one sound or that one word. All the way out, the breath goes with that word. And at the end, it takes you to the blankness. Now, at that point, thoughts can arise, so you should very quickly go on to the next breath. So it's like mu, mu, mu. And what this does is that you'll notice your mind is in a state of blankness for a prolonged period of time. Now, that blankness is so important because it's the door into your unconscious mind. It's a door into your unconscious mind. And if you can't stabilize your body by sitting motionless and stabilize your mind by entering samadhi, you can't get to that emptiness. But once you get to that emptiness, you have to stay there for a long time. And that can be very challenging for people because, they want something to occupy their attention, and you just keep coming back to this emptiness. You know, the emptiness might seem initially to be dead and blank. But eventually, if you stay with that emptiness, it begins to have a transformative effect on you. You know, you go into that blank mind, and eventually you begin to feel this great energy arising. This very powerful, you can sometimes feel this very powerful energy arising. And Zen teachers call this mu energy. Genki Roshi used to say, you have to encounter the mu energy. Now, mu energy sounds like science fiction, but it's actually real. If you practice with the mu koan, you eventually begin to feel like this pulsing energy when you're in emptiness. And of course, if you've practiced Zen at Sesshin, you know that the teacher will ask you to call mu in the Dokusan room. Call mu. And the teacher wants to see your mu energy. Are you able to access or open yourself up to that energy? Now, you know, mu energy is actually the energy that arises when we begin to come into contact with the other part of ourselves. See, it's like going home or becoming whole after being cut in half, cut in two. See, you know, there's a very famous Chinese poem called The Song of the Matching Halves. Song of the Matching Halves. It's all about this. It's like we're like cut in two, you know, and we live half our life because we live so narrowly in just the conscious mind. And the conscious mind is so small. If you've never gotten out of it, it's a great pity. You know, so the conscious mind all day long is just thinking, you know, you go to work and you think, why did the boss give him a promotion instead of me? You know, that's just unfair. And then you become mad. And then maybe you take it out on somebody else who's not responsible. And then you lie awake at night and you go, oh, I should have gotten that promotion. This is so unfair. I stayed many Saturdays while so-and-so went home and played tennis and he got the promotion, right? And it can ruin your day. It can ruin your week. And it can ruin your life, right? Because you're living this small... Who cares? You know, on your deathbed, you're not going to care about, if I may say so, the goddamn promotion, right? You're going to say, what did I do with... Why did I live such a small life? Why did I worry about things that were so trivial and so unimportant? You know, I once had a friend of mine who came to see me in her... She had just gotten her second book published. And she came to see me with the book in her hands. She used to live down the street from me. And she came in and she was so upset because there was a typesetting error on one of the pages. And some of her sentences were screwed up. And she couldn't sleep, right? She couldn't sleep. She said, what am I going to do? You know, they'll think I made the mistake. I said, they won't think you made the mistake. They'll think it's a printer's mistake. And it's, you know... But she was so distressed by this, right? You know, 4 months later, if you talk to her about it, she wouldn't care. But at the time, it was she could not sleep. It was all-consuming, right? You know, with time, these things seem less important because we get out of the spell of the small self. But we live in that world so often, things that are so trivial. You know, my uncle and his wife lived, they had a long marriage, but at one point their marriage almost broke up. And the fight was over how you put the toilet paper on the roll. Should the toilet paper should go over the top or should it hang from the back down, see? And it actually like almost led to their divorce. See, obviously, there was a lot going on unconsciously. It wasn't just about the toilet paper. But it's the small mind that worries about things like that, see. And we can live our whole life in this tiny little mind. You know, in Buddhism, we believe that the conscious mind is like the tip of an iceberg. You know, most of the iceberg is under the water. And so, you know, when you live on the tip of the iceberg, you think you live on a little island. But if you look at the whole iceberg, you live on a continent. See? So, you know, if you've done a lot of zazen, when you look at people in their ordinary emotional distress, it's you want to help them, but it's also kind of sad that they are like a person up to her neck in water, complaining about thirst. See? It's like you have this unexplored continent in yourself and you're bored and unhappy. See, how sad? It's not your fault. It's just so sad. Right? So, you know, doing Zen is learning how to explore this unexplored continent in yourself. We say in Zen, your big mind. And you learn how to sit down on the cushion and enter deep mushin, and you enter this blankness, and this is the door to your big mind. See? And you begin to develop a relationship with your unconscious. It's like now the two halves of yourself are coming, the matching halves are coming back together. It's like, you know, like in the movies, a coin is broken in half and one twin has this half and the other twin has this half and they meet, you know, in Paris or something and they both have around their necks half a coin and they put it together and they realize they're sisters, right? You know, when the two parts of yourself come back together, you become whole for the first time. But it doesn't happen all at once. You have to develop a dynamic relationship with your unconscious, see. And so Zen is about learning how to open up to the unconscious. You know, you know, when you sit in mushin, when you sit with that empty mind, you have to be receptive to the instructions that come from your big mind. They don't usually come in language, see? The small mind, the thinking mind, communicates in words. the big mind communicates in feelings, in images, in intuitions, you could say, right? And so, you know, you might be, if the teacher gives you a koan, you know, like this one, you know, you have no idea what it means, but your big mind is going to help you understand it. So, you know, we Zen people believe that the big mind is highly intelligent, that the big mind is smarter than the little mind. The little mind can do calculus, and the big mind can't do calculus, but the big mind can tell you how calculus can be used in new ways. So you know, the big mind is like the supercomputer, and the conscious mind is like the pad, right? The Chromebook that you carry around with you. So basically, learning how to access that is a matter of learning how to suspend thinking and allowing the unconscious mind to like take possession of your body, a little bit like that. And at first, this is very difficult because people don't know how to do it. And sometimes people don't trust their own intuitions, right? So, for example, one time I was training with a Japanese Zen master, not Genki Roshi, but a different teacher. And we were just doing koans together. And it was raining a lot, and he said, "Why don't you take as your koan the sound of the raindrops?" So I spent 8 hours just listening to the sound of raindrops. And when I came in to see the teacher, I said, "Roshi, Shifu, I said, I am the raindrops." And he said, "That's a pretty good answer. See, that's a pretty good answer. But would you like to see a better answer?" And I said, "Sure." And he jumped up and ran around the room going like a storm. And, you know, I had thought about doing that, but I held myself back. You know, I wanted to do that. I wanted to be the storm. I wanted to run around the room and just go. But, you know, I thought, you're just, what a jerk, you know. So my unconscious mind wanted me to participate in the experience of the rain with my whole being. And my conscious mind said, "Don't be a jerk. You'll look like a fool," you know. But, you know, it's like, why didn't I do that? You know, I could have kicked myself. I wasn't trusting my unconscious mind enough. You know, I'm sure you know this, you know. When you were a little kid and it snowed, it was the most thrilling thing in the world, right? And you go out, you know, you go out in the snow and you just, you know, kids would just throw themselves in the snow. You make snow angels, you make forts, you know. When you're an adult, you know, if I were going to my office at Rutgers and it was snowing heavily and I lay down on the ground and made snow angels, I'd be arrested. You know? See, because that spontaneity is not allowed, right? That spontaneity, that we might say childlike spontaneity, but it's really integrated spontaneity. That joy is not allowed, but it's healthy. And it's not allowed by a culture that puts too much emphasis on the small mind. So, you know, because we only live in one half of ourselves, we're all a little bit deformed. All a little bit deformed. And in particular, modern culture does this to us because the mental aspect of life is so important, and also because we live in a consumer society. You know, so if you think about somebody many of our ancestors were farmers, right? If you think about a farmer, you know, a farmer has to plant seeds, and then you just wait and you hope it rains, right? Can you imagine that? That's how you survive, right? You plant seeds and then you hope for rain. and your whole life is hanging on the coming of the rains. You know, and maybe the rains come and they germinate the seeds and the plants come up, but then you have to get more rain. And what if you don't get more rain? You know, so farmers develop a very different mind. You know, there's nothing they can do to make the rain happen. They have to develop a great patience, you know, like great patience. And of course, they become keenly sensitive to the weather. You know, you might not notice, but they know rain is coming, and so on and so on. You know, so they have a very different kind of intelligence than we do, because they can't command everything to happen. You know, if we want something, yesterday I ordered a book. I didn't have to go to the bookstore. I just ordered it from Amazon. It'll be on the doorstep when I get home. You know, that also encourages like small mind thinking, small mind behavior. You know, having to wait, having to trust, having to be out of control opens us up to the unexpected, to bigger possibilities, actually. So, you know, in Zen practice, we learn how to use both sides of our mind, the conscious mind and the deeper unconscious mind, which is actually fundamentally enlightenment itself. In the course of Zen training, you become more and more whole and complete. When you face obstacles, you don't just use your small thinking mind. You learn how to access deeply this other part of yourself. And it becomes a part of, like an automatic part of the way you respond to the world. It's like instead of getting trapped in small mind thinking, you're always able to enter this larger horizon, this larger perspective. You know, so things that might bother you greatly if you were just in your small mind would suddenly seem like wonderful opportunities to be creative or generous or to experience life more fully. You know, so I know a number of people who lost their jobs and had to do something else. And, of course, nobody likes to lose a job. That is the most... especially in the United States, right? You know, that's terrifying. But these people lost their jobs and they fortunately weren't in a situation where they were desperate. They were able to sort of retool. And, you know, I have three different friends who have gone through this over the last decade, and all of them are much happier than they were. They wouldn't have made the change if it hadn't happened. But when they went through this very painful process, they came out on the other side much happier people. Now, you know, it didn't have to be that painful.